All right. You hopefully got my email about the lab zero. We're going to run through the initial part of that today. That'll be Monday before, I said Tuesday before class, right? So get it to me by Tuesday class time. I'll post the handout. But you'll see the bulk of it's just going to be making sure you've downloaded and installed the Anaconda distribution. How many of you done that already? Good number. Gone okay for most of you? Okay. So basically, it's just verifying you've installed that. Getting used to launching the Jupyter Notebook, which is the primary component we're going to be using, running that, and then submitting files kind of via that, using that as the base for what you're going to do. Yes, ma'am?
My laptop's in the shop right now.
Okay. So bounce me an email, and I'll send you a way that you're able to do this in the cloud rather than a local install. We can get you set up. So bounce me an email pretty quickly, like after class today, and I'll send you a way to go, way to do this. Okay, so that Lab Zero notebook, already posted it. The handout for it's not up yet, but the notebook is there. So basically, if you click here, it'll take you to what's called the Jupyter Notebook Viewer, or NB Viewer. So this is just a static version of this notebook that you'll be able to run. So if for a lot of the notebooks, particularly ones that are just kind of introducing some topics, you can just look at this static version and kind of figure out what's going on, see the responses, that kind of thing. So static meaning that you can't run this version, but it's going to have all the output like you normally would see in the notebook. You know, you can do plots, everything right in line. All right. So if you want to get the notebook that you're going to download, what you're going to have to do is go to the, you know, click on the little Octocat guy. That'll take you to the GitHub repository for the class. And then basically all our notebooks will be in the Jupyter Notebook folder there. All right. You'll see there's a Lab 01 there, and I'll point you to these places in the instructions too, but just to give you an idea, you'll be able to see that notebook. It will actually render it in line for you if you want and show you what it's going to look like. To get just this notebook, you can click on this raw button over here. Right? And that'll basically, it's going to bring up the code that generates that notebook. Right? So if you do that, what you want to do is you can, you know, command, you can save that one. And what you'll have to do, it's going to be hard for you to see here, is it's going to want to put a .txt extension on the end of that when you save it. So you can either chop that off now. You want an IPYNB extension. Right? That's the extension that this notebook recognizes. And it is actually, it wants to put a .txt because this actually is plain text, which is one of the big benefits of running these notebooks. It's nothing special. Just that the notebook application itself knows how to process this text. So you can save it there to your, wherever you want, and away you go. All right, once you've saved it wherever you want to launch that Jupyter Notebook. The instructions will also have point you to the default places where that notebook's looking. So it has, I think in the Windows installation, for example, I think it actually creates a folder in your documents thing that says notebooks or something like that. So you want to put all your notebooks there when you're working. That's going to be where the Jupyter Notebook application kind of looks. You also can point it to a directory, and that's what I usually do. So I have different directories for different projects. But wherever you launch that notebook from, once you launch it, it's going to open up your browser, and you should see something like this based on what files you have. So this is just the current kind of up-to-date Mickey 474 stuff I posted already for that, for our class, right? So you have the list of different notebooks you have there, right? And you just have to click on the one you want to run. And it'll open up, and you have all the cells there ready to go, right? To run a given cell is Shift-Enter, right? So you'll see you're able to write in just plain text, so you can do HTML within a cell if you selected Markdown up here, right? So I can go from editing the raw HTML, Shift-Enter, it processes it and runs that code. So plain text right in line, kind of some instructions. And really this first one is getting to this information for your install. And it's a check that you have all the right packages installed. Right? So it's just running this kind of special command which you have to load. So this just loads it. This is called Watermark. Watermark is the name of this library. And it will just tell you the versions. Next, if you want to run this version, that tells you that you what versions of all the software you have installed. So it's a check for, you know, when you submit this to me, I'll run through and make sure you got the right versions. If you haven't installed things and you try to run this, it'll say, hey, I don't know anything about that controls library, which it wouldn't yet. That's part of the one of the small steps of the lab zero is to install this controls library we're going to use. All right. So you'll get here and say, you're asking it for information about control. It's going to yell at you, hey, I don't have that installed. So this is also a check for you that you got these things installed correctly. And if you're having issues, just bounce me an email. I'll walk you through it and help you out. All right. So basically, this is really what we're looking at. This is kind of lab zero to get to this point, and then kind of walk through some of the other stuff. So how to import the plotting package. That's also kind of outlined in the introductory notebook. And then what we create, the one thing you're going to have to change, you don't have to change anything else in this notebook when you run it. You're going to come in here and replace this seed, the 1234, with the numeric portion of your CLID. All right, so I'm JEV9637. I'd come in here and put 9637. All right, and what it's going to do for you, a random number generator, it's going to start with the same value. It's going to be the same sequence of random numbers all the time based on what seed value you give. All right, so random number generators have that so you can run experiments essentially with using random numbers, but they're the same set from one process to the next, for example. What this is going to do for us is that your set of random numbers will be unique to you, the last four digits of your CLID. And then basically we take that random number generator and generate 500 numbers from it. Take the first 500 it gives us, and we just plot those. So this plot, random numbers will be between 0 and 1. And this should be unique to your numeric portion of your CLID. All right. So, and then basically we import. If the watermark worked above, both of these should work as well. But we go ahead and import them to see, make sure they're working. If you don't get any errors, you're good to go once we start actually doing kind of real fun work with this stuff. All right. So basically what you can do, if you go in and change, go ahead and do it maybe. So these cells run top to bottom, right? And if you just loaded up the notebook, even though there's code there, it hasn't been run yet. Right, so you can't run them really out of order. You have to kind of go from top to bottom running them. All right, so you can always go through and shift enter and just keep going. And just run through the cells that way. And it'll run one at a time. And the shift enter, remember, is what runs the cell. Enter will do a line return within the cell. Right. So that plot should change now. Yeah, a little bit different based on the new seed. The other option you have, if you want to run all, you can go up to kernel and you can restart and run all. And you also have an option to run all under cell. All right, so if you know you kind of want to run the whole notebook from scratch, you can do the kernel, restart, and run all. And it'll clear all your variables, clear everything you've loaded before, restart everything, and run from cell one straight through to the bottom. All right. But basically, if you have everything installed, you should be able to download this notebook, right? Open up the Jupyter notebook application. I think even the most recent Anaconda distributions give you a little clicker, double-click thing to open it up rather than having to go through a command line. And just run this notebook. The only thing you have to change is the seed here. And make that the last four digits of your CLID, the numeric portion. All right. So just, again, making sure we're getting installed. Shouldn't take you long, especially since you've already, most of you guys installed it already. So open, download this up, run it. And then you're going to bounce me the IPYMB file, in this case, just via email. So look for that handout later today. The notebook's already up if you want to get it and just have it ready. Download it. Maybe poke at it a little bit. So that's lab zero. It should all be good to go on that one. Okay. Questions about that at all? I know it was a quick run through, but I think better explained in the handout, and also pretty simple. Yes?
So this is just checking to see if we have all the right.
Just making sure you have everything installed correctly, basically. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Otherwise, if we did, it should run.
If you have everything run, it should just run. So my guess would be if you have problems, you'll see it right here. Right? So if you didn't. Haven't installed the plotting library, for example, which comes with the Anaconda thing, so you should have it. The only one that's going to be a little bit, that might you don't have to install this control, right? And the lab handout has how to do that. It's fairly straightforward, just a simple command. And you actually have to install the watermark extension itself. So that's kind of two places where you're doing beyond what comes with the standard Anaconda distribution. But it's really easy, I promise. Yes?
And also the labs for this semester, I know that you said it was due before the next class, right? I mean, it's on our own time. It's kind of homework.
So for this lab, yeah. So for in general, this lab, it shouldn't take you 30 minutes probably to do it. Labs in general will vary. It'll basically be shifted around depending on what piece of equipment we're using. The first kind of full lab is going to be just kind of simulation based. So that'll be whenever your team can get together and do it. The other labs will be on my lab hardware from the second one on. So what we'll have is kind of a setup where you just sign up for a time slot on a Google Calendar or something. And even that'll be kind of the baseline processing, and then you get to go off and do the remainder of it on your own time. So trying to keep the lab efficient and get you guys an opportunity to touch some hardware too, which is maybe a little bit unique for undergrad controls class. Other questions?
How do you get the specific folder that it looks to?
Sure. So there's a few ways you can do that. So when you get here, when you open it up the first time, you can navigate this structure just like you would a folder structure, basically. So if it opens up in your documents folder or wherever, you can just navigate there that way. So let's see where home's going to take me. So home takes me, I actually opened it within a folder, so home will take me to that folder. I think if you haven't explicitly pointed it at a folder, it will take you kind of to your home directory, basically. And you should be able to bounce around to find the file there.
I think it actually asked me to
assign a folder on Windows, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's what's holding up the instructions, actually. I need to walk through the Windows installation. I haven't done that in 6 months or something. I know it changed a little bit to make sure it still matches up. But if you have issues with any of it, just bounce me an email. Right? This is really just to make sure you guys have everything installed and we're ready to go for the fun stuff. So this is not meant to ding you for not getting stuff installed. Mainly it's to help you get it installed and check that you have it installed. Right? So I'll be around all day tomorrow. And if you're really having trouble going into Tuesday, don't freak out. Just let me know. We'll figure it out. It won't be a big deal. All right? Yes?
Two, I guess, kind of off-topic questions. One is, are you putting it on us to choose our lab team?
No, we'll be doing it randomly, like 201. Yeah.
And then the other is, this is like a relevant tool for us after we get out of school, right?
Yeah, so this Python stuff, one reason I like the Python over MATLAB, let's say. MATLAB's certainly a powerful tool. You can get a lot done with it. MATLAB's expensive for you guys, for one. And would be expensive for me, for my lab. But also, Python is a more general language. Like Google uses a ton of Python. Facebook uses a ton of Python. The very first version of all the server stuff for Instagram was all Python. A lot of the machine learning and big data guys and whatever use a lot of Python. So that language, in some sense, is more versatile than learning MATLAB would be. And I think no more difficult. So you're finding a lot of more companies are using Python too because it's free for them. They don't have to pay thousands of dollars for MATLAB licenses every year. The other thing is you'll see a lot of the kind of open source, which are surprisingly high quality in some ways, robotics tools kind of work well with Python. So ROS is one that you'll actually get a chance to play with a little bit in the lab. Is this big infrastructure for running robots. It's called ROS, Robot Operating System. So Python's a first class language for interfacing with that library. So yeah, the shorter answer to that question is yeah. I think you would see Python again in your career.
Sweet.
Yep. The other thing, I guess, for one reason, one of the many reasons why I force you guys to name stuff a specific way is I have Python scripts that I just point at folders and it runs through and emails them all back to you directly. So I save an hour every time I have to return homeworks or something instead of mailing everything manually. So it's really nice having some Python skills can help you automate stuff like that as well. Other questions?
What's the thing that you have as name specifically?
Maybe you remember from 201, I had you name your reports a certain way and any homeworks you submitted a certain way, like with your CLID and then assignment and all that kind of stuff. So my Python script just looks at the name of the file and it can pick out your CLID and knows I can just append at louisiana.edu And that's your email address and that. So having your CLID in that lets me just point my script at a folder and it emails you all back in 10 seconds rather than me taking an hour to do it manually. Okay, other questions? All right. So today we're going to keep marching along with chapter 2 and get through the bulk of chapter 2, finish that off today. Let's go ahead and kill this. With the exception of, there's one section of chapter 2 we're going to ignore a little bit for right now, discussing signal flow diagrams or signal flow graphs. We may come back to that. We're going to focus more on block diagrams, which is what we're going to talk about today, instead of the signal flow graphs. But we might come back to just be aware of those. So we're going to start working, kind of warm back up since we've all been away a little bit. We looked a little bit at the system before. Our objective here is to get the transfer function for this system from input torque T to output theta. All right, so what's the first step in doing that? Free body diagram. So the first step in getting that transfer function, really what I'm asking for when you're asking for a transfer function of a physical system is what are the equations of motion? And a transfer function is just a convenient way to represent those. Right? So if we want to get equations of motion, we need a free body diagram. All right. What forces do we have?
Gravity.
We have gravity acting where? On the point mass. Our rod's massless, so all the gravitational forces just act on the point mass. What other forces do we have?
Reaction forces.
We have reaction forces at the pin. What else?
Torque.
We have the applied torque. Anything else? No, I agree with that. All right. So we have a rotational system. I think I'm going to also recommend one of the first steps is going to become important, especially as the systems we look at become more complex, is to explicitly identify what your reference frames are. Right. So in this case, what I'm going to draw, I'm going to prescribe one like so. This kind of XYZ frame fixed at the pin of that pendulum. All right. And I'm going to call the point where the pendulum attaches point O for the origin of that frame. All right, so what's next for my equations of motion? I'm going to sum moments around point O. Why point O?
Because it's what you chose. It gets rid of your...
It's what I chose last time?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of main reason. So. There's one reason, if we choose point O, those reaction forces have kind of zero lever arm, right? So they go away, we don't have to worry about them. The other kind of reason we can choose point O is that it's not moving, right? It's not accelerating in any direction. It's a fixed point. We're in pure rotation about point O. So that makes it a really convenient point to sum moments about, right? So I want to sum moments about point O. And remember that those are vectors. Moments have a direction. All right, so what are our moments about point O?
T
in what direction?
Positive
what direction?
Positive.
Yep, positive K direction, right? So our z-axis is pointing out of the board. And when you're doing torques, they go according to right-hand rule. So we have T in the positive K direction. All right, what else do I have? Something to do with that gravitational force, right? So remember I was kind of pushing you guys to think about this in vector notation. It'll become, doing all those triangles in geometry, when we get to more complex systems, it's hard. So the vector is more generalizable to more complex problems, right? So you want the position where the force is acting cross with the force itself, right? So we have that lever arm, so we need to know position of M relative to point O, crossed with what the force actually is. And that'll give us the moment that results from that gravitational force. Right? And I have minus mg because it's in the minus y direction. Right? So what is the position of point O or point M relative to O. Close. Yeah, it's the other way around. L sine theta. All right. So I have that. So we know, if we just kind of look at this, J cross J is going to be 0, so I can kind of ignore that term, right? We know it goes to 0. And then we have I cross J is what?
K.
K, there you go. So and like we saw when we kind of worked the beginning of this example before, all our torques and moments are in the k direction, which if we're saying this, hey, is a planar pendulum, they better all be in the k direction, right? I'm not going to stay in the plane anymore if not, right? So everything's about k. All right, so for this pure rotational motion, what do all those moments sum to? I'm trying to get to equations of motion. 0. If it's not moving. In the static case, it sums to 0.
It sums to your angular acceleration.
Right. So it actually sums to the rate of change of angular momentum, which can be angular acceleration. For the special case, we'll kind of skip ahead to this guy. And we're just going to leave off the k because everything's in the k direction. Alright. What's this I naught? Remember? Or I zero, sorry. I O. Anybody? Moment of inertia. There you go. So this is the moment of inertia. And remember, moments of inertia are defined about some axis of rotation. Right, the same body, if you rotate it about a different place, has a different moment of inertia. So that's what the subscript describes here. This is the moment of inertia of our system about point O. Right. What is that for a point mass in pure rotation? Anybody remember that one? We have a point mass in pure rotation about a point. So the parallel axis theorem will come up if this was a rigid body rather than the point. Oh. And I was rotating about this point. Yeah. So we have just a point mass. This is the simplest.
Squared?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's mr squared. So point mass in pure rotation about a point is the mass times the distance from wherever I'm rotating about squared. So in this case, that's just L. We have point mass m, distance L. So we have okay. So we have equation of motion representing the system now. Trying to get to a transfer function. Can I get there from this equation of motion? We have one vote for no. Anybody agree? Very unsure vote for no, it sounded like. Hang on to that, and we're going to get there in a second. So this is,
yeah, that would probably help.
Yeah. You guys don't remember transfer function? Okay. Can I take the Laplace transform of this system? I can. Let's ask another question. Is this system linear or nonlinear?
Nonlinear.
We have the sine theta term. Right, that's a nonlinear term. All right. So this is a nonlinear equation of motion. What that means is we can't get to the nice, simple Laplace transform form of that equation. Right? It's not linear. We can't get there. So what we're going to do is linearize it. We're going to come up with a linear approximation of the system. What's the first step for a system if I want to linearize it? Yeah, you have to pick out what point am I going to normalize or linearize about? Right? Remember, linearization is only valid kind of where they're constructed. Right? So I'm going to pick some angle to linearize about. Theta equals zero in this case is a good choice. Right? That's a stable equilibrium for this pendulum. Right? What's the other equilibrium for this pendulum if I was going to normalize about an equilibrium point? So I have one here. Yeah, so I have an inverted pendulum. Right, so it's stable at that one point. It's an equilibrium place. So we're going to linearize.
Oh, so that's assuming that the rod that it's connected to is rigid?
Yes, massless and rigid. So linearizing about theta equals zero. All right. We're also, as we walked through last week, are generally going to make some assumptions about how much our variables are changing. Right? And we're going to say, hey, we're going to normalize about theta equals zero for small values of theta. Right? So we're going to assume theta is much less than one, some small value of theta. Well, if we assume that, what does that mean for sine theta? I didn't hear you.
It's closer to 1.
Closer to 1. There you go. For small angles, sine theta is approximately theta. It's cosine of theta at small angles is approximately 1. So if I am saying, hey, theta, I know theta's small, I can kind of skip some of the steps of that full partial differential version of linearization that we did. And so, well, if it's small, I can just sub that theta there. So I can make this substitution. When we get to the linearized equation of motion for the system. Okay. I'm going to collect terms in this guy. All the theta terms on one side. And kind of our control input, T, the torque, on the other. Can I take the Laplace transform of that?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember how to do that?
You replace your derivatives with s, so your double dot would be s squared?
Sure. So this first term, I'm going to put those vertical lines in the middle of the theta to make, differentiate that's a capital theta. And I don't have a derivative over there. And that T. So And those are both in the S domain, the capital letters now. So that's a common notation you'll see throughout the semester. We usually will use lowercase letters for time domain variables, x as a function of t, or theta as a function of t, and we'll use capital letters as when we're in the S domain. So theta's in the S domain now, to the Laplace transform. Right. Remember there was that kind of big long equation we could have plugged this into and figured out what it was. For most of the systems we're going to look at, and I'll point out when we can't do this, most systems we look at, we can take that shortcut. Where you look at a derivative, it's just like a S. An integral is like 1 over S. So we took that shortcut here. We had a second derivative, so it's like S squared times the theta. So two derivatives of theta, you get the theta double. Right? So what is a transfer function? To try to answer your own question now. So transfer function, tell me about the system. That's the characteristic equation you're probably thinking of. Transfer function will give you that information, yeah? There we go. So transfer function is just a relationship. Between the output and input of my system. All right? And we're going to write these in the Laplace domain. Okay? So, what's the output of my of this system?
ML squared S squared plus MGM. Is it
torque? And torque would be the output. Well, what? Yeah, okay. Torque's the input. All right, so I have control over T. And I want to know what? I want to know theta, right? So our transfer function is just going to be, and I'll include the S's here to make it explicit for now, it's just that, all right? So I can get to that by looking up here at my equation in the Laplace domain and just collecting terms and rewriting it in this form. And if I do that, I get that. Maybe I'll write an intermediate step in here for you guys to make that a little more clear. And then collect the terms that way. So that's the transfer function of the system. And what it tells me is basically given some input torque, this is going to map to me what the output of theta is going to be. It's going to give me a lot of information about that. All right. How else could I write this equation? Is there anything I can do to simplify that maybe? Why would I want to do that?
Standard form?
Yeah, it's kind of a standard form. If we have an equation that looks like this, right, we know that that term is actually our natural frequency squared. All right. Probably saw that in Diffie Q, maybe. You have a harmonic oscillator, some kind of system. This is the frequency at which it naturally oscillates. Well, for this system, does that make sense as a natural frequency?
Yeah.
Right? So my m's cancel out. The g, one of the g's cancels out. So does it make sense? For that to be our natural frequency? It's a natural frequency of a pendulum. Is it that? Hopefully. Right? So we can say that's the case, and that is indeed the natural frequency of a pendulum. Right, so that's kind of a good check. Physically, it all makes sense. So we could take this form of the equation of motion and do the same thing and write its transfer function. Right? And quite often we might would take it and write it in this form, actually. What that's going to do now is now if we kind of go through that same process, it's in the notes, but maybe you can take a look on your own and see if you get to the same place. We write it this way. Now we would have an omega n down here in our transfer function. Right? And what that's going to let us do is look at more generalized analysis of the system. So we don't have to look just at a specific value of L, or you know, in the future, if we get to more complex systems, this gets more complex. We don't have to look at every parameter individually. We can look at kind of ratios and relationship between those parameters by writing in terms of omega n. And we'll see writing in terms of damping later. So quite often, we want to get to this form of the transfer function where we divide by whatever is out front of that double derivative term. And you'll see the same things if you guys take vibration. It's tech elective for you, most of you guys, I think.
All that's in the time domain, right?
This is all time domain. So you'd have to take this equation or this equation and now write the transfer function, just like we did here. But you'll see, if you take vibrations, we want to get everything kind of into this form, basically. We want to do analysis based on natural frequency, not based on L, essentially. All right. So this is a linear approximation. How good do you think this is? All right. Any feel for that?
It's good.
Yeah, it's good around some range. Yeah, so we made this assumption that theta is small. Right. So I think up to like 30 degrees, there's only 5% of error here, something like that. So this for pendulum turns out to be a pretty good assumption a lot of times. Right. There's actually a plot comparing the two in the notes so you can take a look at for a certain value of torque. But it ends up being, for a lot of systems, a pretty good approximation.
Is that on both sides too, like if theta is negative 30 degrees?
Yeah, so that sign is oscillating, right? Okay, so hopefully some of this is starting to sound familiar from last week. Let's walk back over to this side of the board. And now we're going to talk about block diagrams. This sets us up nicely to use this as an example. Don't need the free body diagram anymore. That up. This is section 2.6. All right. I'm going to say that we can write, if we're looking for the relationship between our input and output for this system. Right? I want to know I'm given some torque and I want some output theta. I'm going to say, hey, we can write this something like that. All right? So I have some input to my system. It results in some output. All right. And this is about the simplest block diagram you can get. We have a single block that represents how this system is operating. All right. So these are going to be both functions of S. Right. So we are almost always going to be drawing these block diagrams in the S domain, the Laplace domain. All right. So if that's the case for our given system here, what is GP? It's the transfer function, exactly. So if I'm able to map out that transfer function, I can write, which we just wrote over there. Right. Well, this block diagram is all you can think about this in the Laplace domain as anything passing this block diagram is just whatever's happening in that block diagram times what came in. Right? And in some ways it's just rewriting this. There's that. Okay. So if I know this transfer function, I know what the output's going to be in the Laplace domain if I know the input. Right. You guys with me so far? So really, we're so far just rearranging terms and such. All right, let's think about some more complex examples, maybe. First one's not so much more complex. We're going to think about these kind of in general terms for right now, and we'll come back to some more specific examples in a second. So let's say maybe I have some signal x1 going through block g1 to get x2. And then the x2 signal actually goes through, let's say, g2, and the output is x3. What is x2?
G1,
X1, right. All right, what is X3? Well, I know X2 is G1, X1. All right, so now I know the relationship, maybe given some input X1, out on the other side, my output X3. So these transfer functions let us map that out. What it also lets us do you see that these apply, kind of standard algebra rules apply, is to be able to simplify these block diagrams by looking at the combinations here, right? So we could also write this block diagram without the intermediate variable. So it saves us, in some sense, from having to calculate this x2. It just becomes internal to the block. And we'll see when we get to kind of transfer function analysis, we don't want to have to deal with these internal states. We want to be able to write just a single transfer function that relates the relationship from the output input to the output. All right. You could also write this the other way. These guys, order doesn't matter, g1, g2. All right. So that's the first simple one. We can also add signals together. You let me see a kind of a addition represented by some kind of circle, and you'll see either like a little plus sign inside, or you might see one outside over here. Right, so look either place. I'm going to draw it inside for right now. All right. So that's indicating whatever's coming in here is being added, and you might see, you know, negative sign down there is a more common one. I'm going to write this right now just as plus or minus. So it could be either one in this case, most general case. Right. And let's say there's an x2 coming in there. All right. And that's going to go into So what is our total system transfer function, if you will? X3 is what?
G times X1 plus or minus X2.
Yeah. Exactly that. All right. So I could write this also that way. Distribute the transfer function throughout, we're good to go. And we can do all this because we're assuming this Laplace transform is linear transformation. It's linear, lets us do all the kind of fun math stuff to make stuff easy. So how could I rewrite this block diagram if I know that?
Exactly. So I could do plus, plus, and minus.
Something like that. Not immediately obvious right now that that would be any better for us, but be aware, and what we're kind of trying to lay the groundwork for, is that I can kind of massage these block diagrams into a form that I might be more familiar with, a form that might make the analysis easier by kind of playing with the math. Right? And in fact, it's called block diagram algebra. Right? And you use block diagram algebra to simplify your block diagrams or get them into a more convenient form. Right? In the book, there's a big, huge table of these, and they're kind of suggesting, hey, memorize all these things. I think that's not the way to go. All right. I think you can get to all the algebra, all the reductions you need to know about by just kind of looking at the signal and doing the math on it and mapping it out, solving the equations yourself, basically. Because I don't think you're ever going to remember that whole table just by heart. Except unless I forced you to memorize it, and that's kind of stupid. So I'm not going to. Right? So just know that these are kind of the two main operations, right? If things are in line, I multiply them together. If things are adding, I just add them together, and I can simplify from there. All right? So let's look at an example of some of this, and we'll look at how this might work out. What table is that in the book of those things?
2.5.
Yeah, is it table 2.5 that has all those block diagrams? Yeah. So table 2.5. Yeah, has all those guys. Look at it, maybe get a feel for some of the stuff you can do, but don't memorize it. It's not worth your time. Let's get rid of this. All right. All right, so let's look back to the system we looked at in the very first day of class. All right, so we had a mass. On some frictionless surface indicated by our awesome wheels. And we care about the position of the system. We're going to call it X. It has mass M. First day of class, we had two forces on it. We had an external force and a control force. Let's just look at the control force today. And we're going to call that U. So our input to this system is just our control force U, which you'll see is a convention for kind of control forces. We'll call them U quite often. Acting on some mass M on a frictionless surface, and our output, the variable we care about, we're trying to control is X, the position of this mass. All right. So I want to model the system. What's the first step? Yeah, even though it's trivially easy in this case, just be in the habit of doing it. What forces do I have? And my control force. All right. So we're going to say, hey, we're constrained in this vertical direction. Those guys balance. So we don't really care about the y direction. Right. So in that case, we have a pretty simple equation of motion. All right. Can I write the transfer function of this guy? Can I take the Laplace transform as the first step? Yes, what is it?
MS squared.
All right. And then if I want to write the transfer function, it's really just rearranging that equation, right? What's the transfer function? Output over input, so what's our output?
Our output's MS squared X.
Output's just X. All right. So there's a transfer function for this simple force input. Okay. So hold on to that. Okay. So what's simplest block diagram representing the system? There we go. Let's maybe put lines to make sure that we keep that a capital X. Avoid any kind of confusion. So we have input, we have output X, there you go, transfer function. And we're at GP. And just as a reminder, we mentioned it before, but the P there stands for plant. It's kind of a leftover from process control days. A lot of this stuff started with process control. So the plant I'm trying to control is P. So you'll still see that in terminology come up even when you're talking about mechanical systems. What's the plant of the system? It's the kind of mechanical, physical thing you're trying to control. All right. So, pretty simple so far. We came up with a system on the first day of crafts. We thought about how might I get kind of our objective. We wanted to get X to some desired position, XD. And we talked about maybe properly generating some kind of bang bang command. Right? And they said, well, we also, if we can measure X, we might be able to use that to figure out what our force needs to be, our input force. Right? So let's draw this again over here. We said, hey, if I can measure X, if I know some information about my system, I should be able to do something with that to figure out what the input force needs to be to get me to where I wanted to be and stopping there perfectly. All right. So I'm going to measure X. I can kind of indicate it like that in a block diagram. I'm going to take some information about X and, in this case, feed it back towards the beginning of the system. All right. In this case, we say, hey, what we want to do is compare X and XD. We want to know something about, well, how far am I away from my target distance location? All right, you guys remember this vaguely? We talked about the first day? Okay. So say, hey, I'm really far away from my target. I want to probably be going really fast. Just hammer on the gas as fast as I can go, right? I get closer, I want to let off and start braking maybe. Right? So we want to do something with it. So we don't only worry about saying what we're going to do. I can have some block there, GC, representing our controller, that's going to take the difference between XD and X, do some stuff based on it, to generate the force that goes into our plant for our system. And you can think about that variable there as really just the error, right? It's the difference between my desired state, XD, and my actual state, X. Right? You see that? So I have some desired state, X. I compare it to my current state of the system to get some error. I do some stuff on it. Just let that go for now. We'll think about what GC needs to be in a second. And based on what GC is, I generate some force that goes to my system. And that, of course, kind of affects X. All right, so let's march through this block diagram and see if we can get to maybe a simpler form of it. All right, so what is U in this case? Just from the block diagram. Sure, but work. There we go. All right, and we knew that the output X, capital X, because we're in the S domain, is just GP times U. Right? We just kind of keep marching along that guy there. Right? So we also know then as well, right? So I could take this block diagram, and write it in a kind of intermediate form, let's say. It looks something like that, where this guy is still E. I keep forgetting my line. You guys see how I did that? All right. Well, what we know what E is as well, right? Let's see if we can simplify this even further. Right? So just took, I knew what E was, plug him in there. Just do the algebra, collect terms. We'll simplify already. XD. All right. Now I can write, I can actually write the relationship between my desired position and the output. I'll put X so I can simplify this entire block diagram into this one transfer function. That. Okay, so let's look at these two cases here. What does this transfer function tell us? All right, let's look at this equation. So we could have our input in this case for this transfer function is E, and the output is X. All right, so what does that transfer function tell us about our system? Generalize a little bit. Basically, it tells me what the output's going to be as a function of the error. Right? So if this system is some deviation from the desired state, right, based on what GC and GP are, I know what the output's going to be. Right? And yeah, of course, this requires me knowing what GC and GP are. Right? But this is kind of tells you a function of how the system responds is a function of the error from the desired states. That can be very valuable in terms of control system analysis. Right. So you'll see this guy. Often called an open loop transfer function. So there's kind of not taking into account really the feedback. And we'll see, kind of, I think it's more obvious why this is called open loop when we talk about the next one. All right. So, coming back over here, what does this transfer function tell me?
Based on a distance you tell it to reach, it'll give you a certain x.
Right. So, given my desired states, final states, or time history of those states even, this doesn't have to be a single fixed point. Right, this could be a path, maybe, even. Right. It's going to tell me what the output is. All right. Does this take into account this measurement? Right, so this includes the whole feedback control mechanism. Right, so this is a loop. It is completely closed with this transfer function, and this transfer function includes all the information about that feedback loop. Right, so this transfer function is the closed loop transfer function of this system. All right, it includes closes the loop, it's got all the information about that feedback control loop. All right, you see this one, right? This is just kind of the forward path. So this guy doesn't include that whole closed loop, so he's open loop. Let's look at this closed loop transfer function. What are the poles of that transfer function? Talked about those briefly last week. Not quite. Right. So what is this, the polynomial that this would be in the S domain? What is that called? Characteristic polynomial. If you set it to equal to zero, it's a characteristic equation. Right. This is going to be some function, and we'll get to kind of more specifics and hopefully today. Some function of S. Right. You set that equal to zero. Whatever S satisfies that are your system poles. Right. So in this case, because we know that transfer function is a closed loop transfer function, we can actually say that these are the closed loop poles of the system. All right. What does that guy tell us, the numerator of our transfer function? We had poles and
roots.
Zeros, there we go. Zeros. And you could call these the closed loop zeros of this function, this transfer function. So where the numerator equals zero are zeros, where the denominator equals zeros are your poles. And what we'll continue to see throughout the whole semester is just knowing poles and zeros gives me a lot of information about my system. I can look just at a mapping of those, and we did that, I think, on day one. Just a mapping of those in the S-plane, and I can get a lot of information about how the system responds. Right. And in some sense, our control system, picking GC, is going to be all about picking what these closed loop roots are, what those poles are. Right. All right. So that brings up the question, which should GC be? Right, we said we kind of have it as a black box right now. We're taking in the error from our desired state and generating some force based on it. So what should GC be?
It's got to be something that it's like some sort of iterative thing that transforms or any distance. I don't know.
Sure. So this loop, you can think about this loop as running in real time. It's infinitely fast, what's happening here. So we can measure something and act on it instantaneously. Right, so the signal transfer is instantaneous. These blocks might have some delay in them, though. But so yeah, we're always acting on the error. Well, if you think back, it was a long time ago. On the first day of class, we said, hey, well, maybe we should generate some force proportional to how far I am away from the target. I'm really far away, I want to really be pushing on it hard. As I get closer, I probably want to be pulling on it to stop it. Right? So we wrote it like this. Let me start in the time domain. We said, hey, my input should probably be proportional to how far I'm away from my target. Right? Look familiar a little bit? We also said, well, hey, that doesn't quite get us there, and we actually, that ends up in an oscillatory response. So I end up overshooting my target and having to come back, and I do that forever, actually, if I just have this proportional controller. We need some damping, right? So we need some derivative term, too. We need some term that considers the velocity as well. Right. So what you have there is a time domain version of a PD controller. Right. You're doing something proportional to the error and something proportional to its derivative. D is for derivative. Okay, so what's the Laplace transform of this guy? Well, let's write back up a half step. What is that? XD minus X.
Error.
Error, right? So that's what's that one?
Error.
Yeah, just the derivative, the time derivative of that error. All right. So I have, I'm going to say my control input is proportional to the error plus something proportional to its derivative of the error. What's the Laplace transform of that guy? So, what does it tell us about this then? If we pick that as our transfer function, back over to what the output's going to be as a function of the error. Well, we know that x to error is that one, right? So if we just plug in, we have GC as that, right? Let's finish writing this. That's why it's not clear. The output of our controller is U. The input is the error. Right? So that transfer function, output over input. And that's going to tell us what GC is. There we go. Well, now I know that this is just and I know GP so now I know the open loop transfer function of this mass with the force input with a PD controller. Right. And I can do the same thing and get some information there. Right. I can plug this in and get the closed loop transfer function of this PD controlled mass. Right. I'm going to go through the couple steps of algebra to do that for you in the notes. We'll skip it right now. Okay. One other point I want to get to today that we'll forego some algebra for is thinking about to this system. All right. Do I always want the input to my system here to be my desired state or desired position in this case? Does that make sense? For every system, I say, I'm going to tell the system exactly where I want it to go and pass that directly. No. Why not?
What if you don't have a fixed point?
Well, this can be a function of time. Right? So it could be, yeah, that this is an exact path mapping out through space or something.
But we
talking about something like moving?
Well, xd. xd is a function of time, right? So xd can be some function of time. So it can be changing.
You don't know, like, the environment, you know? Like, if it goes up a hill, it's moving for 5 seconds. Like, how do you measure the distance? You know what I'm saying? You'd have to map out.
Well, yeah, so we're assuming so far I can measure where I'm at in space exactly, right? That's what this feedback loop, and I can measure my derivatives exactly, which is another issue we'll get into later that I'm never able to actually do that. So, I'll answer since we ran out of time. No, we don't want to always make XD the input of the system, right? So, for example, a good example, kind of following on, right? I might have some XD that's 5 miles from here, right? It doesn't really make sense to be making my local control inputs based on a target that's 5 miles away, right? And kind of that human scale, right? So I might map out, this might be a function of time, right? So it could be I'm actually making control decisions based on something more intelligent than just, hey, go to 5 miles, right? At each time step, I want you to be at a certain location, right? I could perhaps map out from XD to some kind of velocity that I want to track over that time too, right? So the point I'm trying to make here is that you don't really want to pass XD to your system. Well, see, there's a whole class of inputs that kind of assume you're doing that. Quite often, you want to do something else out here. You want to take your desired input, your desired system states, and maybe operate on them in some way, right, to generate a reference trajectory for your system to track. Right. So for example, for the crane stuff you guys saw in the videos the first day, you might remember from 201, those of you that are in there, right? So the crane, if I tell it to, hey, go from here to there, and that's all I tell it, it's going to vibrate like crazy. Right. But if I'm smart about what I put right here, then I can get from point A to point B without any vibration, right? And really all we've thought about is, hey, don't pass just XD. Don't be dumb about just giving it your desired final state. Think about what's the best reference trajectory for my system to track to get to XD. All right. And that could be used with that feedback control system or without sometimes, right? And I make this point explicitly here because you'll never see this in a textbook. Haven't run across a single undergraduate textbook that even tells you to think about it all what you're actually asking the system to do, right? That's what XD is here in this loop, right? This XD, or kind of R as we have it drawn now, that's what I'm asking my system to do, right? And if you don't give that any thought at all, which is kind of the direction most undergrad textbooks push you guys in, then designing a control system here, picking GC to get good performance is gonna be really hard, except for trivial examples that you see in textbooks, right? So, the kind of bigger point I'm trying to make is think about what command you're feeding your system. Right? Make that an explicit choice. One sec. Don't just feed it, hey, these are the states I want, and go. Yeah?
So hypothetically with the crane, mm-hmm. you want to be able to tell it, like going around a corner, for example.
Sure.
You want it to be able to tell you to first, with that reference point, to be able to take the corner first. And not
vibrate,
and then
sure. So, yeah. So, even that corner, right? You could have, or in that case, you probably actually have two inputs, right? You have kind of one direction and the other. So they're separated out. But even in the cornering case, you may not even want to feed in just the straight waypoints to the system. You may want to do something smarter so that you don't vibrate. And we'll get to there's kind of a couple lectures we're going to do in this technique called input shaping. And that's really about picking what goes in this block in a smart way for vibratory systems. Yes, sir?
Couldn't that change? I mean, that could just constantly be changing, right? Between jobs, between situations from A to B, right? Like
yeah.
Weight, distance.
Yeah.
Okay.
All this stuff could be changing.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? So, yeah, I mean, this plant model, you know, if this is a really simple model of a dump truck, I have some force I can generate by stepping on the gas effectively. When I fill it up, it's going to behave a lot differently. That M changes, which changes the location of the closed loop poles. which represents a change in the system dynamics, which probably means I need to change what KP and KD are. Right? So, yeah, it's not easy to do, right? And then kind of to follow on, make, you know, stress this point one more time, is if I haven't thought about all that stuff, right, picking GC, I'm just slamming on the gas and assuming some mass, it's not the right mass, it may not be so good. All right. So look for, I'll email when the lab zero goes up. Again, it shouldn't take you long. And if you're having trouble, just let me know. We'll help you through it. It's not a, but kind of the goal is to get everybody through it by class time on Tuesday. All right, thanks.